The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Good evening. Welcome to The Dan Proft Radio Show. My name is Julie Kelly. I am a senior contributor, writer for American Greatness, amgreatness.com. Joining me now is Arthur Millick. He is a friend of mine and a young up-and-coming voice and leading thinker of where the conservative movement now, so to speak, is headed in this post-Trump era. And you've seen this split between the establishment Republican, even think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and the legacy publications like National Review, who are sort of at odds in many ways with where the new right is headed. And so Arthur is at the forefront of that. He is with the Claremont Institute. We'll talk a little bit about what that is. And this new Center for the American Way of Life, which is described as reinvigorated and restored conservatism. Arthur, thanks so much for coming on tonight.
Thank you so much, Julie, for having me.
Arthur, explain a little bit who the Claremont Institute is. We know who appreciate all of their hard work, but who is the Claremont Institute? Who's involved and how they've really become so notable over the past several years in the Trump era?
Sure. Well, the Claremont Institute has existed for 40 years. It is a California-based think tank that does a couple of things. We publish the Claremont Review of Books, which in my opinion, and I used to say this before I worked at Claremont, that it's the most interesting and serious magazine on the right. We have several educational programs for young future elites where we train them up to understand where the country came from, where it began, and what has become of it, and what can be done about it. And we have trained generations of very successful and impressive young people. And then the Claremont Institute has just opened its new branch in Washington, D.C., which I am heading up, standing up. And our goal is to thank you very much. Our goal is a couple of things. Our view is that the country is in trouble and that the establishment of conservatism does not understand fully, does not appreciate the threats to the country. And we like to think of it this way, that we are in a regime-level crisis. On the one side of that crisis stands the Republican self-government, the American way of life, and on the other is identity politics. And identity politics right now has all of the advantages. It has not only the moral momentum in controlling and policing the moral high ground in our country, but more importantly, it has very successfully captured all of the institutions, the major institutions of the nation, the universities, the schools, the Fortune 500s, large parts of the media, the image-making industries, big tech, and the administrative state. And we are outgunned and outnumbered. And establishment conservatism, for the most part, refuses to see this. And so we've created this new center to reinvigorate conservatism, to put it on the right track of understanding what it's actually fighting for and what it's actually fighting to preserve. And just as importantly, to wage battle against these institutions that the left has taken away from the right while the right was asleep.
I think I want to read really quickly because I think this gets to the crux of where you are and your organization and this new center is versus everybody else, the establishment conservatism. So this is from the statement. Much of the conservative establishment came to view the pinnacle of human life as private consumption and personal license, defining national health by GDP growth. It did not understand this perspective led not only to spiritual enervation, the weakening of patriotic sentiment and the demotion of political liberty, but also to the creation of new oligarchic elite openly hostile to the nation. boy, that nails it. That's exactly what has happened over the past few decades. While the establishment conservatives sat there and talked about what, free trade and low tax rates?
Yeah, that's right. Their vision for what national health and happiness was turned out to be very narrow and captured only a peaceful moment in time, but is not a durable strategy. The idea being that so long as the GDP is growing, everybody is happy and there's peace. But the truth is that that very peace, that very GDP growth, can sometimes produce very bad effects. Like, for example, the things that I list: spiritual enervation, the belief that human life is only about consumption. And the problem of that is that it makes you forget that political liberty should be the primary focus of a political party, its preservation. And you cannot have both of these things. You cannot have a citizenry that is on guard and practicing its political liberty, living it out, while also thinking that its entire existence is merely private, is about just spending, money making, and consumption. And that view drove us into the situation that we're in, because it's those kinds of citizens that were developed by this view that GDP growth is the end-all be-all. It's those kinds of people that are taken advantage of and, frankly, run roughshod over by an accelerating, more fanatical left, which, while we were spending and consuming, took over all of the nation's institutions and is now using them to implement a kind of oligarchic tyranny, a rule by the few.
I think that that has been a huge revelation for people over the last few years, that no, a country's health is not measured by, you said, the GDP, the Dow Jones, how all of these economic gauges that we were really taught, this is the measure of a healthy society. And I hear this more and more from people. People alarmed that families are breaking down. We heard a little of this in the early 90s from some people who were laughed that, okay, broken families, that doesn't mean anything for at least the white people, right? We looked at it in inner cities, thought it was a problem. But now people have observed these are the same problems universally. They're not just in certain communities. They're even in the upper income, the wealthiest communities have these problems too, whether it's drug use or families breaking apart, loss of faith, loss of religion. Those are major problems for a country. And I think that that's why people are sensing this country really is falling apart, even though the economy looks sort of okay. But this is a heavy lift, Arthur. Where do you guys take this to lawmakers, to communities? How do you start getting people to pay attention to this?
Right. Well, look, I am of the view that there is still a great deal of hope. In many, many regards, this is still a very healthy country. And I'll give you just one example, that even though President Trump lost the election, even though in a certain way many of his policy victories will be reversed or didn't even happen, nonetheless, one of the greatest victories of his presidency is exposing this illegitimate rule of elites over the country. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Americans understand that now. And they are both angry, they feel that an injustice has taken place, but at the same time, they are still attached to Republican self-government. They are still attached to liberty, to political liberty, to ruling themselves. They still feel that it is illegitimate for their fake moral betters to rule over them. So I'm not hopeless. That spirit exists in Americans, and it can be revitalized. And it requires a new political movement. It requires a new rhetoric to revive that noble sentiment in us that we can and ought to rule ourselves. But that's not enough. It also requires a taking down of, an undermining of, the institutions that the left has accumulated that illegitimately rule us. I'll give you just one example. Why is it that each state has a partially state-funded university that is teaching its students to despise their parents, mm-hmm. to despise the country, to even to a degree despise themselves? Why is it that conservatives just stand by and tolerate it and say, well, a rosy day will come? These places can be defunded. Mm-hmm. This is within our power. And we have to look institution by institution like that and take away their funding, change the laws so that those institutions are weakened in their grasp over young people and just generally American minds. I'll give you another example, big tech. How is it possible that one private woke corporation like Google can control 90% of the worldwide internet searches, which is the portal to information? Mm-hmm. There are legal means like antitrust that can be pursued. Conservatives have not been thinking like this for the last 30 years because things have been more or less rosy in the country, even though just underneath the covers they've been bad. So it's a rechanneling, it's a rethinking of our strategy that is very important today. And I think that that is the future. In fact, I think that's the only future that's possible for us.
Thank you so much for your work. It's well needed, and I wish you all the success because the country depends on it.
I'm coming home, baby.
Come on home.
Coming home, baby, now.
You know I'm waiting here for you.
I'm coming home now real soon.
You've been gone.
Coming home, baby, now.
You don't know what I'm going through.
I'm coming home, I know I'm overdue.
Since you went away.
Expect me anytime.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Good evening. Welcome to the Dan Proft Radio Show. You can tell by my voice I am not Dan Proft, unfortunately, because that guy really has the life. My name is Julie Kelly. I am a senior contributor, writer for American Greatness, amgreatness.com. If you haven't heard of us, I hope you can check us out. We're a relatively new publication. We've been online about 4 years. We've got some great writers, Victor Davis Hanson, Conrad Black. You can find Selena Zito's work there. A lot of new up-and-coming writers as well. I am going to have my publisher on, Chris Buskirk. Later in the show, we are going to talk about the late, great Rush Limbaugh, his impact on all of us in conservative media, and his legacy. So before we get into it, I've also got some terrific guests on. I'm talking to Steve Malloy, who is an expert on the climate change cabal, as we call them. He is going to be talking about the disaster that's happening in Texas. Thanks to the Republican leadership's over-reliance on clean energy, such as wind turbines that are now frozen, millions have been without power in Texas thanks to an unprecedented snowstorm. So we talked to Steve Malloy in a little bit. Also going to be talking to my friend Kurt Schlichter, town hall contributor, author, radio host, one of the funniest guys out there right now, also very active on Twitter. He is going to be talking about what's happening in California, his home state, and the recall effort of Gavin Newsom, which is picking up steam. I think last time I checked, they had 1.7 million signatures. By the way, I think signature verification is going to become a new thing, a hot thing again after the 2020 election. No one cared, but that's going to be important in California. Also, I'll be talking to Kelly Torrance. She is with New York Post, talking about the meltdown of what's happening with Governor Cuomo. Boy, the Democrats are not having a very good week at all. You have the Democratic governors of the two largest states, people ask on both sides of the political aisle and the media, surprisingly, calling for their heads. Andrew Cuomo is not handling the pressure well at all, which is a delight to see because he deserves everything that is now coming his way and more so. And we'll talk to Kelly Torrance about that. Also, I'll be talking to Arthur Millick at the Claremont Institute. They are, I guess you would call them the antidote to the old school establishment conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation. They are launching a new effort, and this is called A New Conservative. A New Conservatism Must Emerge, and this is really where conservatism goes in the post-Trump era. Of course, we still have the president as the leader of the party. But what exactly can these institutions do to continue to promote not just the policies of the Trump administration and President Trump, but certainly his approach to politics and taking off the gloves a little bit and fighting the real battles that are just not policy, but also culturally. Arthur is a very smart young guy, and he's going to be talking about that effort. As I mentioned, also talking to my editor, Chris Buskirk, in a while, shortly here, about Rush Limbaugh and conservative media's future. So unfortunately, and we've been hearing tributes again all day today, honoring Rush Limbaugh, who, as all of you know, tragically passed away yesterday after a year-long battle with lung cancer. It's amazing he survived as long as he did. If anyone knows someone who's been diagnosed with lung cancer, usually you don't survive that long. But we know he was a fighter. He endured really horrific treatments over the past year. I think he did that because he knew that we really needed his voice this past year, and what a hole we will all have in that 12 to 3 our central time here in Chicago, 11 to 2 time of the afternoon without Rush. So he certainly will be missed. Here is how his wife, Catherine, announced Rush's passing yesterday.
I, like you, very much wish Rush was behind this golden microphone right now.
She went on to explain that he had passed away. And even though we knew it was coming, everyone on social media yesterday and in friend group chats still were shocked to hear the news. People were crying. I know there were other radio hosts who were talking who were, you know, choked up in tears, talking about what he meant to them, what he meant to this space, this profession. This would not exist but for Rush Limbaugh, his pioneering, and really all that he endured from the left, and sometimes even from Republicans, trying to cancel him. He was the original target of the modern day cancel culture. And you could see on social media yesterday and even on cable news shows the venality of the left once again in full display, cheering his demise. But it's not because of what Rush said or did. They are angry that even though he passed away too young, he went out on his own terms. They did not cancel him. And in fact, towards the end, especially in the Trump era, he was an early supporter of Donald Trump. He actually got stronger. He grew his following instead of having it shrunk by the people on the left and Democrats, mainstream media, who wanted him out. You know, I've heard some interesting descriptions of Rush Limbaugh. People have just obviously referred to him as a radio host, as an entertainer, you know, a conservative figurehead. But he was one of the top influencers on the right over the past three decades. He was not just an entertainer. He was not just someone who hosted a radio show. There was no one who could light up the switchboards at the White House or on Capitol Hill like Rush Limbaugh. He helped promote ideas. He held Republican legislators, lawmakers, governors to account. He helped back people like Brett Kavanaugh when Republican lawmakers were getting wobbly. He was not just a voice for all of us who are already involved in the movement. He helped persuade tens of millions of people. You saw this yesterday and today. People who said their parents started listening to Rush and they were listening to Rush's children, and that's why they became conservatives, and that's how they got into conservative media. Some of them even said this is why they ran for office, growing up listening to Rush behind the golden microphone. And so his passing, of course, tragic, sad news, but his legacy continues on. And it was so good yesterday to hear from President Trump. He appeared on several shows talking about his personal friendship with Rush Limbaugh, but also what he meant to him professionally, what he meant to the MAGA movement, and how much he'll be missed. So we'll play a few of those clips in a little bit. We'll be back after this break.
But it must have been the right time. I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong song. I've been in the right vein, but it seemed like a wrong on.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
So as a lifelong Midwesterner, it's very easy to mock and make fun of certain areas of the country when they get a dusting of snow. Particularly, I find it amusing when this happens in, say, Washington, D.C. or Atlanta. But look, what is happening in Texas is not funny. It is really a catastrophe on many levels, and nothing that anyone is making fun of. But so I have on with me today Steve Malloy, a friend of mine who is the head of junkscience.com. He's the author of many books. He is very familiar, up to date with the whole climate change, clean energy scam. And he's here to talk to us today about what's happening in Texas, who's to blame for these massive power outages. And then we'll talk a little bit about Joe Biden's climate change cabal, who's involved and what we can expect. So, Steve, thanks for coming on today.
Hey, Julie, thanks for having me here.
So if you could tell our audience tonight, what is the situation in Texas? Who is to blame? And what's happening to these millions of people without power?
Okay, so, you know, what's going on in Texas right now is really a failure of government. You know, as Reagan said, you know, government is not the solution, it's the problem. Mm-hmm. And for the last 12 years in Texas, they've been sort of moving towards a, you know, for lack of a better term, a Green New Deal. They've been getting rid of reliable electricity generators like coal and bringing on board wind. And so wind has come to be a major part of Texas's electricity grid. And so, you know, we have this storm coming down, which is, you know, it's an unusual storm. It's going to be unusually cold, or has been unusually cold in Texas, and, you know, snow and ice and just general, you know, winter nastiness. And the Texas grid is not ready for this. Even though, you know, we all know, we've known for more than a week that this is coming to Texas, Texas still wasn't ready for it. And so, there probably was nothing the grid operator could do because they're so reliant on wind. But they were hoping they could make it through. And when this nastiness came through, the windmills froze. And, you know, they could not bring up the gas, and they didn't have enough coal to bring up quick enough to fill the gap. And so the grid just basically collapsed. And, you know, more than 4 million people in Texas were without power. Some are still without power. They're going to be without power for the next couple of days. You know, probably I think 20 people or so have died. Many have been in all sorts of misery, and it's just been a disaster for Texas. And you know, it's a man-made disaster caused because, you know, people have designed the Texas electricity grid for political correctness purposes, not based on any sort of rationality. Texans have been paying higher prices for electricity because of the wind and solar. They're not getting anything for that. It's not like the weather is better or the climate is better or the environment is better or the air is cleaner. They're just paying more, and this is what they get. And, yeah, this is unusual, but, you know, keep in mind that the you know, climate hysterics tell us that, well, we're just going to get more weather like this. In fact, they say that, you know, this cold snap is actually caused by global warming. Well, let's just say that's true. There's more of this coming, and what are the windmills going to do? I mean, it's just, you know, this has just been a man-made, a government-made disaster, and you know, Texans should hold all their politicians accountable, not just Democrats, but Republicans as well. About a year ago, Texas Governor Greg Abbott boasted that half Texas is the number one state in electricity, and Texas was a country. It would be the, you know, number five country in the world with wind. Well, I had to point out to him that, you know, this week, if Texas is the number one state without electricity, and if Texas were a country, we would call it India, right?
Good for you. Good for you. Well, Steve, before we head to our break, I think it's important to underscore that Republicans are as responsible as Democrats for pushing the folly of clean energy. I mean, Texas is completely run by Republicans. I'm no fan of Governor Abbott, especially how he's conducted himself during the lockdowns. But this is a Republican problem in Texas and in other states.
Yeah, well, taxpayers have subsidized the wind industry, and the wind industry has taken those subsidies and has bought all politicians on both sides. There's not a politician no Republican politician can run away from what happened in Texas. Not Abbott, not Ted Cruz, not John Cornyn, none of these people, nobody, because they all supported it to one extent or another. And this is true across the country. And this is a bipartisan problem. You know, in California, run by Democrats, you got the same problem. I mean, you know, the commonality is, this green energy is terrible, and they're using taxpayer money to buy these politicians, and we're the ones paying the price.
After this quick break, let's talk about the Biden clean energy plan, how Republicans might get on board, and how taxpayers are going to pay for it.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
So with me now is Steve Malloy, the head of JunkScience.com, author, expert. He can detect all the BS before it happens, really, anything related to climate change or especially clean energy. So, Steve, we know that climate change is a top priority, if not the top priority, of the Biden administration, bringing back all of the Obama hacks like Gina McCarthy from EPA, John Kerry, who pushed for the Paris climate deal. Of course, we're allegedly getting back into that agreement. But there are tens of billions of dollars in subsidies in the previous COVID package deal. I don't know if it's in the $1.9 trillion. I'm sure it's buried somewhere. But this idea that we're going to go to zero carbon emissions, that we are going to replace our highly effective, low-cost energy grid with wind, solar, hydropower, batteries, et cetera, what do you expect to see? What are you already seeing, and what do you expect to see over the next few years in terms of climate change policy from Biden?
Well, yeah, the fundamental problem is that Joe Biden has made, climate bedwetting, for lack of a better term.
Your favorite term, I know.
Yes, the central organizing principle of his government. Every agency is supposed to... climate is the top consideration, even at the Department of Health and Human Services. Next week, Javier Becerra is having his confirmation hearings. He's going to run Department of Health and Human Services. Climate is his number one concern. At the Defense Department, climate is the number one concern. This is, of course, crazy.
Whole-of-government approach, they call it,
the
right?
The whole-of-government approach, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, so what's going on in Texas? Well, this is going to happen to the rest of the country if we're going to be designing our energy systems around political correctness, which is what climate is all about. If it's true that we're going to have more extreme weather, well, then we need reliable electricity, not wind and solar. If we're going to fight wars, well, we need fossil fuels. Who you can't rely on batteries to fight a war. That's crazy. So we're just going to see more of this. We're going to see prices go up. We're going to see reliability go down. We're going to become a third world country if we let, these English majors, no offense to English majors, but, they should not be designing our energy systems and telling us how to live. I mean, editing papers is fine. Writing books is fine. But, they can't do that kind of stuff. Everyone's got to know their limitations. And unfortunately, people in government don't.
Steve, where are most of the solar panels in the world manufactured?
Well, they come from China.
Really?
Yeah, and a lot of them are made by slave labor.
Shocker.
In China.
Right.
Right. Well, that's the only, you hear these claims all the time that, solar and wind is cheaper than coal. Of course, none of that is true. First off, they've artificially raised the price of coal for a number of reasons, which we probably don't have time to get into. But one of the reasons solar and wind are affordable at all is because they're made by slave labor in China, a place where they don't pay anything for the workers, and you know, they have no environmental regulation, so there's no cost there. You know, these things are basically made for free, and they're still expensive.
It was so galling, and I'm sure you found this as well, to see White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki a few weeks ago completely downplay, if not completely dismiss, the idea of energy workers in the U.S. being fired, especially those working on the Keystone Pipeline, other energy systems. The old learn to code is now the learn to build solar panels, but we don't really manufacture these parts here. And furthermore, they can't be manufactured without fossil fuel. You can't build a wind turbine, right, without fossil fuels. You're not building that off of wind energy. Yeah. Correct.
So we can't do anything without fossil fuels. But, you know, going back to what you were saying about, you know, Jen Psaki and the jobs, and, you know, Joe Biden said this, John Kerry said this, and Gene McCarthy have all said this, you know, there's going to be renewable energy jobs. Well, yesterday, Vestas, which is a the largest wind turbine maker in the world, they announced they were laying off people. They were killing jobs in the United States. Mm. So these green jobs don't even exist. We're just killing oil, high-paying oil and gas jobs. You know, blue-collar Joe killing high-paying blue-collar jobs. There are no wind and solar jobs. You're right. You know, all the manufacturing jobs are in China, and that's where they're going to stay because no one could afford to make solar panels and windmills here. So it's all going to be in China. The wind industry is cutting back here. You know, what kind of public policy is this?
We already see energy prices increasing, ticking up a little bit. What do you expect for the average consumer? I mean, you have state budgets already breaking due to what's happened over the past year with lockdowns. The last thing anyone can afford, either your household, your business, or state government, local government, is higher energy prices.
Yeah.
Where is this headed? What can people expect?
Well, so this is something that elites don't get because they make so much money that, you know, electricity bill is really kind of trivial. But for the rest of the rest of us, electricity bills, gas bills, they matter, and prices are going up, and we're not getting anything for it. You know, we're supposed to be paying more to save the planet, but the planet's not being saved. Nothing is changing. You know, the rest of the world, even if you do, you know, believe this global warming fantasy, you know, caused by man-made emissions of greenhouse gases. Well, you know, in China, they're burning as much coal and gas as they can, and India's coming online, and Africa, and, you know, we're not making a difference. We're just destroying our standard of living for no reason, and our national security as well. You know, when you kill all these, you know, if we're not going to be energy dependent and energy dominant, well, then we're just going to be dependent on OPEC again. And you know, instead of paying $2 or $3 for a gallon of gasoline, we're going to be paying $8 to $10 for a gallon of gasoline.
Wow.
So there's really no, you know, there's no upside to any of this green stuff because it's not accomplishing anything. No one is living longer, a healthier life. It's, you know, the environmental justice is, you know, it's just another hoax. The climate is not changing. The weather's not getting better. We're just shooting ourselves in the foot for no reason.
Steve, you are always my go-to source on these issues. You've taught me so much. And where can people find your work? And I know you had a book out a few years ago about the EPA. So if you could tell people where they can track these issues and learn more, that would be helpful.
So my book, which you can get on Amazon, is called Scare Pollution, Why and How to Fix the EPA. Which a lot of these changes we did implement during the Trump administration, but that's over.
So, sadly.
My website is junkscience.com, and you can get me on Twitter, where I spend a lot of time because that's where most people are, at Junk Science. So,
well, I'm such a fan of your work. Other people should follow it. I know you have a big following, too. Thank you so much, and keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me, Julie.
DanProfShow.com.
Democrats are not having a good week, which the Democratic Party is in as bad, if not worse, shape than the Republican Party right now. And that was a lot of what impeachment sort of covered up. But now that that is over, you are really beginning to see what is happening, especially with the Biden administration. They really are in a tailspin on a number of issues, especially related to the COVID pandemic, vaccines, school closings. They're starting to get pressure even from the media and the left. For the most part, for a large part, this pandemic is over. We now know that this is a seasonal virus. It always was. We know that it's mutating just like viruses do. People are getting sick of wearing face masks. Our elite public health experts, as I use in air quotes, now are, instead of recognizing and telling everyone, oops, sorry, face masks don't really work, they're legitimately doubling down. The CDC coming out with guidance saying now wear two masks. Pretty soon it will be three masks. Maybe at some point we will all just have to wear scuba gear or be like John Travolta from the 1970s movie Boy in the Bubble, because they will not admit, have a grown-up conversation with tens of millions of Americans who are still unjustifiably terrified by a virus, which if you contract it, most people don't even know that they have it. If you get it, you have a 99.7% chance of recovery, and the vulnerable people most vulnerable not only need to be protected, but actually have been exploited by our ruling class, i.e. Andrew Cuomo and other governors who mixed nursing home patients. The country, luckily, is fatigued of this. We're almost a year away from 15 days to flatten the curve. People want to get back to normal. But you know what? We won't get back to normal until Jen Psaki tells us it's okay.
What's going on here? When do we think we will get back to some taste of normalcy?
I think the president wants things to return to normal, as we all do. But we don't know at this point what that timeline is going to look like.
Wow. Imagine having so much arrogance and hubris that you think you could tell 330 million Americans when they can get back to normal. But here's the little secret, probably not a secret for you all listening. It is imperative that the Biden administration, for many reasons, keeps alive the panic about coronavirus, COVID-19, not only till they get their $1.9 trillion quote-unquote relief package passed, so they can pay off public school unions, et cetera, all of their constituencies. This helps keep Joe Biden under wraps. This keeps Joe Biden not traveling. It keeps him from not meeting with congressional leaders. It certainly stops him from having to wake up for more than a half hour a day, sign a few executive orders, refuse to take questions from the press, and who knows what he does the rest of the day. So Jen Psaki and Joe Biden don't want us to go back to normal, mostly, actually completely, for political reasons.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Joining me now is my boss, publisher, editor, and friend, Chris Buskirk. Chris, in 2016, helped launch American Greatness at amgreatness.com. It has really taken off. I say it has taken over many of the legacy conservative, quote unquote, conservative outlets that we all grew up really reading and our parents did, but just do not understand what time it is and what's happening in the country right now like we do. So Chris is on today. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I want to talk first about Rush Limbaugh. We just keep seeing these tributes. They were all over social media, regular media yesterday, all day today. We heard from the president a few times, which was great to hear from him. Let me play a quick clip of what Donald Trump said about his friend, Rush Limbaugh.
It was a great honor to do so when we gave the Medal of Freedom. It was something special. It was an incredible night. We gave it during the State of the Union address, and it was especially half the room. Half the room went crazy, and the other half the room, they knew he should get it. but it was special and he was special. It was a great honor to do so.
It's hard to believe, Chris, that that was a year ago, February 2020, at the State of the Union address.
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem like 10 years ago? So talk a little bit about Rush's impact on you personally, and then you as creating this new outlet for news and opinion on the right.
You know, I got to tell you, Rush is one of those unique people. Like, there's, you get these debates in sports, like who's better, Michael Jordan or Kobe, or, you know, Magic Johnson or Larry Bird or whatever. Like, there just isn't a debate about who did it better in conservative media in the past, like, 40 years. I mean, Rush is, like, he was the GOAT, right? He did it. Everything he did was original. He was very smart. He was entertaining. He was, like, you know, just from everybody who knew him, he was just sort of a sweetheart of a guy. But he was completely sui generis. He was unique, and he did it in a way that was totally creative. You know, without Rush, I think it's safe to say that, you know, talk radio never really would have existed. Political talk radio never would have existed in the way that we have sort of come to rely upon over the past few decades, right? Mm-hmm. Think about what talk radio was in the 70s or 80s. I mean, it was completely weird and random stuff. And Rush actually created the entire genre himself. And he's the one who inspired a lot of other people who are now in the business to get into the business. And even the best ones, nobody did it as well as he did. And he was extremely influential for all kinds of people. I was one of our occasional contributors I saw had a tweet up, which I thought was great. It said something to the effect of, being in your teens and working a manual labor job while your boss blared Rush Limbaugh mm-hmm. all afternoon is an American rite of passage. And I thought that captured it pretty nicely, because, like, I actually know somebody right now who's about in her early 20s, works as a mechanic in an auto shop. And he's in exactly that place. You know, for the last 4 or 5 years that he's been working in that shop, his boss played Rush every single day. And it was just, you know, it was kind of that 3-hour daily dose of entertainment, but also of, you know, good political common sense.
And I think that it's such a great visual, because everyone can relate to that. And people are describing him as a radio host, as an entertainer, obviously someone who had great influence on the right, but he was a major influencer. No one really could light up the switchboard on Capitol Hill like Rush Limbaugh could, right? So if he felt
100%,
no one could do that, even the president. So I think some people are sort of downplaying his role. We see people now in the establishment, right, especially at National Review, mocking, you know, dismissing him because he didn't read all of the classics, apparently, which I'm sure he did. He just didn't have to boast about
it. He did. Rush was a super intelligent person,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the thing. It's like, you know, if you want to know when somebody understands something, yeah, and when they, like, they just really get it in their bones and they understand it better than anybody else, it's not when they take 1,000 words or 5,000 words to explain it. It's when they can explain a complex concept in one sentence, and somebody who didn't understand it before understands it after they heard that one sentence. And that was, you know, that's Rush.
Perfectly
he could take
said.
Things that were very complex, and he could distill it into something that was very simple and understandable, and everybody immediately got it.
What about it? And I would argue, too, and I'm sure you would agree, even the people on the left who were, of course, they're twisted, sick people, right? They're not normal, nice, good-hearted, decent-souled people who were cheering the news about what happened with Rush. But there are a lot of people on the left, either cable news or radio show hosts themselves, who picked up what Rush was doing because he was such a pioneer. They adopted his ways, tried to make it their own. But he was a big influencer on the left, too, even though they don't want to admit it.
Oh, no, of course he was, because he was so good at what he did, and because he made it look easy, he made it charismatic, and everybody knew the amount of influence that the guy had. He had an enormous audience that kind of, you know, was all walks of life. He did it for a long time. And so, you know, I mean, Rush was basically the Beatles, right? I mean, you know, everybody liked him, and everybody wanted to in some way kind of emulate him. And a lot of people picked up a guitar because of him, you know, so to speak. And, you know, if you talk to musicians from the 80s or the 90s, a lot of them, you know, were inspired by the Beatles. And, you know, they was like jazz musicians and heavy metal and country. And they also heard like these harmonies from the Beatles. And they're like, yeah, I want to do that too. And they did it in different ways. And it's exactly the same thing with Rush. Rush just made it so he just made it seem easy and fun and charismatic. And he inspired like a generation or two of other people to try and do something similar, to try and follow in his footsteps. And nobody's filling those shoes, but a lot of people have tried and continue to try.
I think another thing he taught us, Chris, he was the original target of the modern day cancel culture. And I was listening to a lot of the tributes yesterday, last night on Fox News, people on Tucker and Sean Hannity, and hearing more of them today. He really taught us how to confront the mob, how to make sure you know who you are, perfect your craft. So, you know, people who are insecure, I think, are very easily swayed by the mob, forced to apologize because they don't know who they are in their own skin. And he knew who the enemy was, and he was never cowed by them. And I think that that is such an important lesson, message, legacy for all of us now, because we're all being targeted, whether it's by big tech, whether it's by regular media, whether it's by lawmakers who want us silenced. I think that's another big takeaway. How he handled that over 30 years, it really is something that we should all emulate.
Well, and it's happened to him multiple times. I mean, you remember he had the TV show that didn't quite work out. But that was not, it wasn't even because of the quality of the TV shows, because people didn't want him on television. He tried to be part of a partnership to buy an NFL team. They would not allow him to buy to participate in that partnership because of who he was. You know, after the Sandra Fluck stuff, a bunch of advertisers, right, were, you know, there was this sort of effort to organize his advertisers to boycott him or to drop him. Some did, some ultimately came back, some never went back. But, you know, here was Rush. He was just, you know, he had such a big audience. He was so good at what he did, is that he just, you know, he was the Energizer buddy. He just kept going. He was never cowed, as you say, and he just, you know, he knew exactly what he was about. And he wasn't trying to bob and weave and trying to figure out, like, you know, what the game theory is. Well, if I say this, what are they going to do? You know, he had an agenda and he stuck to it. And, you know, that's, we can really emulate that. We can really learn a lot from the way he conducted his own business and his own life in that sense.
On the other side of the break, I do want to talk about where media on the right goes and the split that we see between, you know, establishment right, the new quote unquote MAGA right, that's not only happening on Capitol Hill, but also in media. But Chris, what do you, I feel like Rush got stronger at the end during Trump's presidency. What do you think in the final seconds where he was at the end?
Rush, he went out at the top of his game. That's the thing, is everybody was waiting for, you know, when's Rush kind of going to, when's he going to like lose a step like an athlete who's a little past it? You know, he never did.
Right.
That was, you know, but for the cancer, Rush would have kept going for a long time. He was very energetic. He understood the issues that were important to the country. And he was, you know, he never got to that point where he, you know, like a lot of people do, they kind of sound like they're just repeating what they learned 10 or 20 years ago. He was always out at the forefront, you know, really got where politics and culture were and knew what needed to be said and knew sort of what people needed to hear.
That's right. And we'll talk next about how we keep his legacy alive.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
On with me is my friend and publisher and boss, Chris Busker. I hope he's not mad that I'm doing this instead of writing another column. Am I going to be in trouble?
Not mad, no. I'm just disappointed.
Go. As usual, another Julie Kelly disappointment.
Yeah, I don't get angry. I just guilt trip.
It works. It works.
You're right. What can I say? I have an Italian mother. I learned it. I learned it growing up.
See, I'm a WASP, so we feel no guilt. Talk about American Greatness, the outlet that I am privileged and honored to work for. I just am always eternally grateful for you for the opportunity. How American Greatness got started in 2016 and how it's grown and had such influence. Rush would read our articles regularly on the air, and how we continue to take over the voice of the right and crush our competitors on the boring establishment, useful idiot right.
Yeah, I mean, look, so we started in 2016, which seems like a blink ago. It was July of 16. It was just about like this point in 2016, like February, March, where the idea kind of came up and we started to plan for what ultimately became the summer launch of American Greatness. And what we saw happening around us was a quote unquote conservative movement. And I'm using scare quotes intentionally because I'm still trying to figure out what this conservative movement was trying to conserve or what they were successful in conserving. You know, and this was, you know, nobody knows in February, March, April, May, June of 2016 if Donald Trump's going to win the nomination. We think he probably will. Definitely don't know if he's going to become president or not. But one thing we knew for sure, like 100%, is that the American right was broken. You know, it had lost both the will to win and the knowledge of how to win. And if it somehow fell backwards into a victory, it had no idea what to do with political power when it got it. And it was just this like sort of husk, you know, this neutered husk of a political movement. And that was the thing that, Donald Trump sort of tapped into back then. It was like people fired up. He said, you know, we want, you know, what happened to all our manufacturing? What happened to all our jobs? Why did we, you know, who won from this? Why did we ship all this to China, you know, while Youngstown, Ohio is suffering? You know, why are we, you know, the people sort of at the bottom end of the income scale, the working class, hasn't had a raise in 40 years. But so why are we importing more unskilled laborers from Latin America to compete for those same jobs with them? You know, and so all these sorts of things were, you know, had people going, absolutely. Like, why we need to, like, take care of our own people. Why are we in the middle of all these kind of useless, you know, endless forever wars all over the world? And Donald Trump talks about these things. And these were things that were basic to the American right for decades and decades and decades. And they just kind of went away after, you know, I kind of say, I mean, you could date it differently, but, you know, I would say for sure by the end of Reagan's second term and things kind of changed. The Cold War ends and then, you know, kind of the neocons and the neocons and the libertarians basically, you know, feast on the carcass of the American right and use the base as cannon fodder to win their battles. But in their political battles, but in the meantime, like the country's not doing any better. And so, you know, we're looking at this since 2016 and said, you know, all of those legacy, quote unquote, conservative journals and magazines, National Review and Weekly Standard, you know, all those ones, well, they don't actually represent anybody outside of like Manhattan and Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Like Republicans in Phoenix and Akron and Wichita and Dallas are looking at this going, that's what it means to be conservative? No, because that's not good for anybody except maybe you guys, but the rest of us out here aren't doing as great. And so that was kind of the genesis of the idea to say, you know, we need a magazine, we need a journal that kind of makes the argument for what historic American conservatism is about. You know, what is, Trump would say things like America first. Yeah, that sounds good, but what does it mean? Mm-hmm. Like, how does that play out in real life? And so, you know, that was kind of the idea behind founding American Greatness. And, you know, kind of to bring this full circle, when we launched in July of 2016, you know, one of the people who was really instrumental in us getting attention and starting to get regular readers was Rush Limbaugh. Mm-hmm. Like, he was very, very good to us. You know, he saw what we were doing. I'm not even sure how he found out so quickly that we were out there, but he did. And, you know, he would, even till last month, you know, he was regularly reading stuff that we published online. He was talking about it, but that started back in the summer of 2016. And so, you know, I mean, look, to his eternal credit, and, you know, I will always appreciate that about him. Like, he, as I was saying earlier, this was somebody who led. You know, he saw, you know, like, basically this upstart web magazine is like, okay, yeah, like, I get that, and I want to help promote them. And, you know, I will, as I say, I'll always be appreciative of that.
There was no, and I know you know this too, but there was no bigger thrill than when my phone would start blowing up and people saying, oh my God, Rush Limbaugh's talking about your article, or Rush Limbaugh's talking about American greatness. And I mean, that it was, that would make your day, your week. I mean, it didn't happen to me a lot, but the few times that it did, it was a good day.
I'm laughing, Julie, because every time Rush would read one of your articles, I would get texts from both of my parents. Like, oh, Rush is reading one of Julie's piece from this morning. Isn't that great?
Well, it was. It was beyond a thrill. And so, you know, just one of the many things we will miss about Rush. But in our last few minutes here, Chris, you have this establishment, bipartisan beltway crowd who thinks really we're just going to go back to 1994, right? We're going to go back to talking about free trade agreements and, you know, compassionate conservative immigration policy, and go back to talking about the tax code. When people recognize that the country is really breaking, the country is sick, families are suffering, communities are suffering, and it's not because we don't have, you know, a minimum wage or we don't have tax breaks. It's a bigger picture. That's what I talked to Arthur Millick about. So in our last minute here, American greatness continues to grow, build its influence. Who are you targeting? Washington, state legislatures, governors, communities? Where do we put this movement and this energy in our messaging?
Everything, Julie, because there's so many people who are reading American Greatness now. And so, you know, a lot of them are in Washington and they've got work to do there. But, you know, I'm in Arizona just by way of example. I know people who are very involved in state politics here who are reading American Greatness and looking for, you know, for sort of guidance on, you know, where is the right headed, you know, how do we think about these things? How do we prioritize our goals? What are the most important goals? So, you know, look, it's a big country. There's a lot of people who are involved in all kinds of levels of politics, and we need to be focused on all of them. I mean, not any one person can't be focused on all of them, but my point is that there are so many people who are involved in this. People need to pick where they can be most effective and just, you know, work on those things.
Can you stay on one more segment and we can talk about that? Because I think that's important. So sit tight and we'll talk about that next.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Chris, back to what you were saying, I think it's so important. You know, everyone thinks they need to fly to Washington, D.C. to have an influence, and that's the last place you really should be. So talk a little bit about more the need to reinvigorate or keep this energy going at the grassroots level, how people can really get involved, because a lot of people's eyes are open for the first time. They want to get involved. They want to do something. What can they do?
Yeah, well, pick your spot. That's kind of my advice. You know, pick the place where you can be effective. I think people sort of get overwhelmed when they're trying to figure out, like, oh my gosh, there's so much to do. That's true. Clearly, that's true. You know, but there are places where everybody can have an impact and where you have some sort of expertise. I was in the last segment, I was kind of saying, you know, one of those places be a precinct committeeman. That's actually really useful. Mm-hmm. You know, we need good, smart conservatives who are actually running the party apparatuses. You know, people always complain about the Republican Party. God knows I do. But, you know, part of it is you just have to have good people who are in control of that apparatus. You know, that's one place that people can be effective. But, you know, there are all kinds of other institutions, big and small, where if you just get involved with them, you can actually have influence. Now, are you going to change the trajectory of the country with that one thing? No, but you don't need to. You just need to be effective where you are. You know, if you're, you know, sort of like if you're faithful little, you'll be faithful in much. If you're good at that little thing, eventually you can be good maybe at a bigger thing too. But the in the aggregate, these things really add up. And this is a place where, honestly, where people on the left think about politics in a very different way than people on the right do. People on the right tend to think about politics as, you know, it's all very ideological. It's a lot of times it's very intellectual. It's like, well, what's the right idea here? And the left does that too. They clearly are ideological, but they literally have manuals for their activists about how you do things. Like in the Obama years, we'd always make fun of Obama, like, oh my gosh, he was a community organizer. How dumb. Ha ha ha. What do community organizers do? Turns out they actually do a lot.
That's right.
And, you know, last year I bought a bunch of the manuals that the left uses to train their activists for community organizing and for direct action and all these things. These are the sort of manuals that they would be giving to, you know, young officers at the Army War College. What I mean is they're very practical.
Right.
They're very detailed. Like, you go in and you follow these steps because you're trying to, whatever your particular policy or your goal is, here's how you can do it. Here's how you can get people to support you. And here's how you can create a groundswell. And here's how you can pressure institutions. I mean, I really think that more people on our side should have that practical approach to politics. It doesn't just take care of itself. Like, you have to be organized. And this is a place where we always get out organized.
I think it also speaks to, I'm sorry, I think it speaks to the failure of the establishment conservative movement over the last few decades, as they are the last at least 20 years, that they don't have any of this infrastructure in place, right? They had none of it.
Yeah, no, none. Well, I mean, literally none. I mean, and that's, you know, and that's a shortcoming. When you don't have it, you know, the difference between having it and not having it, I think, shows.
In our last minute, let's talk, too, about money. People, you know, whether it's $5, $10,
$100. This isn't the part where you ask for a raise, is it?
Yes, I'm going to get you on record. Please. Stop sending your money to the National Republican parties, whether it's for Senate, the House, certainly to the GOP. Where should people like to put their money where their mouth is. What should they do with their small or big donations?
This is a good question. So, I mean, yes, I would say that's right. Do not give money to the big committees. Don't give it to the national party. Don't give it to the Senate committee. Don't give it to the House committee. If you're giving like political, like election type donations, find the candidates that you think are good. Like, vet those candidates and give them money directly. That does two things, by the way. One is it supports that candidate directly, which is what you're ultimately trying to do anyway. It also makes those good candidates more independent from the RNC and from those committees. Because one of the things that happens, it's very real, it's very practical, is that the RNC and the House, and you know, the House Victory Fund and the Senate Victory Fund, they have a ton of money in them, and they use that as leverage to get the members to do what they want to do. So
Right. Everybody
complains about, like, Mitch McConnell. Like, why do people count out of Mitch McConnell? Because he controls that fund, and they need the money in their elections. Don't give the money there. You know, empower the senator or the Senate candidate or the House member, the House candidate that you really like, and give them the independence.
Chris Buskirk, I'll text you about my raise later. Thank you so much. You can find all of our work at amgreatness.com. Chris, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, Julie.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
There is a small group of people, luckily, that I'm connected with, who are doing yeoman's work on what's happening with the coronavirus pandemic and the lockdowns. They really are crunching all the data. They pay attention to everything state by state, city by city, and they are, of course, criticized if they're coming out with the wrong message. God forbid we show all the great things that are happening, good data from Florida, and not giving cover to the Democratic governors who have done basically everything wrong. One of those people is Justin Hart. He's with Rational Ground. He's a data analyst. And he has been, from the very start, I'm not sure how we got connected early on, Justin. I'm sure it was on Twitter, right?
Yes, likely on Twitter.
The work you are doing, though, and you do this nonstop, and I don't even know if you're getting paid. I don't know if this is just, you know, your passion right now, but very few people have been on top of this from the beginning like you have. So thank you for coming on. Want to talk to you today, though, about the mixed messaging and the poor scheduling planning that's coming out of the Biden administration on school reopening. And what's great is you are starting to see even the left and the media, Democrats, start to turn on the Biden administration for breaking their promise about opening schools. Jen Psaki a few weeks ago said his pledge would be fulfilled if you had one day in person, one day a week in person school, and the rest was virtual by the end of the 100 days. But here's what Joe Biden said at the CNN town hall a few nights ago.
Your administration had set a goal to open the majority of schools in your first 100 days. You're now saying that means those schools may only be open for at least one day a week.
No, that's not true. That's what was reported. Uh-huh. That's not true. It was a mistake in the communication. But what I'm talking about is I said opening the majority of schools in K through eighth grade, because they're the easiest to open, the most needed to be open in terms of the impact on children and families having to stay home.
So when do you think that would be K through eight, days a week?
I think we'll be close to that at the end of the first 100 days.
What do we make of that, Justin?
Lots of waffling. Look, if we look across the country, an entire third of the country, 33%, are still in virtual-only schools. 25% of the country are in a hybrid solution, and only 40% of our students, K through 12, are in a traditional in-person everyday school. And again, you know, he's adopting that terrible statistic where it's basically one day live in school counts as a school being opening. That he counts that here in California. And here in California, we have like 5% of our schools open. And so it's a dramatic and dreadful impact on our kids. They all know this, but it's obvious that they're basically beholden to a lot of special interest groups, particularly the education teachers, union associations, and it's just making a terrible life for so many people. And I hear from conservatives, I hear from progressives, I hear from a lot of people who are quickly becoming one-issue voters, which is get my kids back in school as quickly as possible.
And the party of science is not at all following the science. Justin, talk about the data that you have been fixated on and crunching for months now about schools staying open and how it is not a threat to spread the COVID-19.
Yeah, this is hugely impactful. Look, the median age of death for COVID, while it's a challenging disease, is 80 years old. Mm-hmm. To compare that to the 1918 pandemic, the median age of death there was 29 years old. If COVID killed even just like your regular influenza, we would have seen hundreds and thousands of kids dead. Instead, it's in like three digits, right? And what we see is that kids are not major transference points and vectors for this disease. But most importantly, we see the impact it has on kids, especially even kids as they get into the high school ages. About a quarter to a third of them have had ideation around suicide this last year. And just consider this statistic, because lockdowns have impacts. And it's kind of like butterflies and hurricanes. You know, a butterfly flaps its wings and a hurricane happens over here. Just consider this fact, and anyone can understand this and understand its impact. The University of Florida, University of Michigan did a study that just for March and April, for the shutdown months there, 250,000 reported allegations
of domestic abuse were missed. Why? Of child domestic abuse, you can think about it. You know why? Because those are typically found by teachers and by schools, right? So just consider that impact on our kids' lives.
And which kids, of course, Justin, are the most at risk? Who's falling behind? Who is being ignored? You know, it's not the upper class suburban families. Who's paying the long-term, lifelong costs for these unnecessary, inhumane school closings?
Oh, absolutely. That's the most dreadful part about it, is that our folks who are lower income, our immigrants who have come here, they're the ones that are challenged the most. The Fairfax School District, they in Virginia, one of the largest in the country, they did an assessment to try to understand what was the failing grades from 2019-20 to the 2020-21 season. And they saw for all middle and high school students, the percentage of Fs that they got, an 83% increase. Hispanic students, 92% increase. Students with disabilities, 111% increase. English learner students, 106% increase. Black students, 60%. I mean, you just go on and on, and their lives have just been impacted dramatically. And again, you know, look, they say it takes about 10,000 hours to become an expert in anything, whether it's a violin or a piano player or a sport, or for that matter, mathematics, right? You become an expert after putting in all of that work. Well, guess what? Our kids have lost over 2,000 hours of in-person learning. And just imagine the impact that has on their lives. Those are hours they can't get back.
After this break, and I agree, getting grade schoolers and high schoolers back into class is imperative. But there is another crisis that's not being covered, and that's what's happening on college campuses to our young people. Let's talk about that after this quick break.
Come on, turn.
Listen to the podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
So, Justin, yes, it's imperative that we get our kids back into the classroom K through 12. But what's happening on college campuses is an untold story. And I know this because I have a daughter in college. A friend called yesterday, daughter at a public university in Kentucky, test positive. She's now in an isolated dorm for the next 8 days by herself. Can't even go outside. She's not even sick. But because they have this insane testing regime on these college campuses, our kids, college students, are being treated worse than prisoners in solitary confinement. Talk a little bit about what's happening at our public colleges, private and public, across the country.
Yeah, take, for example, Berkeley, you know, one of the most progressive cities in the world, and in California, and that's saying something. And they basically determined that kids cannot even go out to exercise, right? Mm-hmm. Now, think about this. We know that one of the comorbidities that exacerbates the issues if you were to contract COVID are obesity, lack of vitamin D. So why are we sticking our kids inside? First of all, their susceptibility is very low. Second, the testing regime that we have is completely off base. The New York Times did an article, this is almost 6 months ago, where they looked at actual testing and looked at lab results. So they took the samples and sent them out to a lab and say, can you grow a COVID culture from these things? And they found 40 to 90% of all of the testing that came back had no indication of actual viral loads, meaning that these tests are so sensitive, they can pick up whether you've had a virus in the last 5 days to the last 75 days. And that creates just this terrible scenario where we're constantly testing our kids, especially in colleges. And when we went through, we did the fall testing, it was hundreds of thousands of kids who were tested and two hospitalizations. And of those two hospitalizations, neither of them were actually at school.
It's terrible. Anybody who went to college, you envision your normal college experience. I mean, these kids are isolated. They're alone. They haven't made new friends. They haven't met their professors in person. Greek life is completely shut down. If any fraternity sorority has a little party, they're kicked off of campus. I know this sounds frivolous, but it's not. These are rites of passages. This is what turns you into an adult. We are punishing these kids for absolutely no reason.
Well, and think about, for example, even just the athletics part of this thing, right? Mm-hmm. There are kids whose life trajectory will be absolutely changed because they didn't have the opportunity to play in their junior and senior year and get recruited to a major pro athlete endeavor there. Or think about all the recruiting that has to be done for scientific endeavors that were put on hold. Just an absolute, complete hiccup. And really, you know, it is the administrators, it is the school people mm-hmm. who are doing this, and it is the fear that's been instilled in people that has caused them dramatic increase on this.
It is inhumane and catastrophic. Justin, I wish we had more time. Tell people where they can find you and your work.
You can find me on Twitter, Justin_Hart, or you can find all of our articles we put up with backed up data on rationalground.com.
Thank you so much. Keep up the good fight. We need it.
Thanks, Julie.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft. And this is the Dan Proft Show.
Boy, if there's any highlight, there's two highlights to 2021 so far. Number one, the complete embarrassing, humiliating collapse of the Lincoln Project. Number two, the political comeuppance of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. No other outlet has been on this story from the beginning, calling him out on his nursing home policy back to the spring of 2020, then the New York Post. Happy today to have Kelly Jane Torrance with me. She is on the New York Post editorial board, and we are going to have a good old time talking about Andrew Cuomo's political crisis. Kelly, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Julie.
So what's the latest? I feel like every hour there's a new bombshell revelation or he's making a new threat to someone. What is happening in New York this week?
Yeah, this week has just seen crisis after crisis, I would say, for Governor Cuomo. You know, it all started last week when it came out that his closest aide, the top aide, Melissa DeRosa, told a group of Democratic lawmakers that they did cover up the nursing home deaths, that they did stonewall. Legislators had been asking them since last year for the numbers of how many people in nursing homes actually died, and they refused to say how many died in hospitals. And she admitted that they covered it up. She claimed it was because they were worried about a federal investigation from President Donald Trump, which, you know, saying that you were going to hide information because of a federal investigation, I think that in itself needs a federal investigation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just went from bad to worse. You know, she actually apologized to lawmakers for holding that information back, but neither she nor the governor has apologized to the families of the thousands of seniors who died because of his March 25th mandate that said nursing homes had to take in COVID-positive patients. Mm-hmm. It's insane. Why would you send people with this deadly virus into the environment where people were most vulnerable to it? He finally rescinded that mandate in May, but it's clear it was deadly.
Well, Kelly, as you know, this is what the governor has to say about all this. I don't understand what's everyone upset about? Let's hear what he said.
A third of all deaths in this nation are from nursing homes. New York State, we're only about 28% only. But we're below the national average in number of deaths in nursing homes. But who cares? 33, 28 died in a hospital, died in a nursing home. They died.
Wow.
Chalice Cuomo, that's what I call him. I mean, it's incredible. And, you know, I will say one, you know, this is a bipartisan issue that people in both parties are going after the governor. And Assemblyman Ron Kim, who is a Democrat representing Queens, he lost his uncle in a nursing home, and he has really been going after Cuomo for this. And so Amazingly, Cuomo calls Assemblyman Kim and says, "You have not seen my wrath. You will be destroyed. You will be finished." He called him trying to get him to put out a statement rescinding all of the criticism of Cuomo that he's had and to take back his statements to the New York Post about what he said.
And he was really harassing Senator Kim, wasn't he? I mean, he was calling him nonstop on the phone. And
Kim said that his wife could hear Cuomo yelling at him. It was that loud. He was in the middle of bathing his children when Cuomo called. And, you know, a couple days later, he said Cuomo called 5 or 6 more times, but he did not pick up. This is just, you know, unbelievable. And Cuomo kind of had a meltdown one day this week during a press conference that he brings up some legislation some years ago about mail workers to attack Kim, saying that Kim had been funded by the nail salon owners. I mean, it was just bizarre. Cuomo is really grasping at straws here. Instead of just admitting he made a mistake, apologizing, saying, you know what, we made a mistake, let's do better. He's just attacking people in his own party. It's incredible.
And the Democrats, and I mean, even obviously you guys have been on the case. What about New York media? Is the New York Times covering this? What about local stations? Do you sense that this really is, the tide is turning against him quickly and harshly?
It is, Julie, and I'm so happy to see it. Yeah, we've really been at the forefront, and I'm not just, you know, tooting
our
own horn here.
You have.
The governor himself has criticized us in the past, saying this is just a political issue made up by the New York Post. And in a statement this week, his top advisor, Rich Azzapardi, did this 800-word statement. And again, multiple times mentioned the New York Post and tried to claim we are making a political issue up out of this. So, yeah, there have been a few other places that have been covering this, but not much until that revelation from Melissa DeRosa that they did, in fact, cover up the numbers. And what's amazing to me is just yesterday, CNN claimed it's reinstated a rule that prevents Chris Cuomo from interviewing or covering his brother. This is amazing. CNN now says it has standards now that Governor Cuomo is getting widespread criticism. But throughout the pandemic, almost a year now, you had Chris Cuomo jokingly interviewing his brother while thousands of people died. Just to give you some of the numbers, the day before Cuomo's administration came clean, they claimed that there were 8,740 seniors in nursing homes who died. The next day, when they finally came clean, they admitted it was 12,743.
What do you think
Monday,
the number is?
Close to 14,000.
Oh, okay. So it keeps going up.
And, you know, we're still wondering if they're giving the complete numbers. People have some questions, some discrepancies. But, yeah, in one day when they changed the numbers, it went up by 50%. That's how many deaths they were hiding.
And this is obviously a problem not just for New York, even though that's the biggest case. There are Democratic governors in New Jersey and Michigan who also had this similar order. And you saw Ron DeSantis answer this a few days ago where he said, "We didn't have that policy. We were on nursing homes right away. We were not readmitting infected patients." And so just another discrepancy between how Democratic governors have handled this crisis and a handful of Republicans, because there are a lot of Republicans who mishandled this too. So, Kelly, in the last few minutes here, is there a federal investigation? We see the FBI, I don't think it's the Southern District of New York, but is their Justice Department interest in this? Have the Biden administration commented on this? What's next for Andrew Cuomo?
Yeah, the Biden administration is keeping very quiet on it. And
I bet.
Cuomo actually met with the president earlier this week to talk about COVID relief. And the press secretary was asked, "Did you guys talk about this?" She said no, which, you know, is mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, there's word that the FBI and the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York is investigating his handling. We hope that something will happen. But, you know, one of the funny things in that phone call that Melissa DeRosa had with Democrats, she sort of expressed some relief, saying, you know, the President Trump's DOJ was looking into us, but now it seems we're fine. They're not looking into us. So they certainly should be. I mean, this is just shocking. It's outrageous. And, you know, I have to say, since we've been revealing all this stuff, Governor Cuomo is refusing to take questions at his press conferences from the New York Post. He, you know, one day he took two questions from the Daily News, zero from the New York Post. It's amazing. But, yeah, the tide's really turning. You know, Mayor de Blasio was on TV this morning, asked about Cuomo's bullying. Is this something you've seen before? And he said, that's classic Andrew Cuomo.
Now, there's no love lost for people outside of New York. There's no love lost between those two egos. I mean, not surprising, but they're not palsy-walsy, are they?
No. You know, they've, especially throughout the pandemic, you know, Mayor de Blasio will say, we're closing schools. Cuomo will say, you don't have that decision. We're not closing schools. And then the next day, close the school. So, yeah, they do play this sort of bizarre cat and mouse game. But what's amazing to me is, you know, a number of Democrats here at the state level are actually moving to strip Cuomo of his emergency powers. He's had them for nearly a year now, and he's used them to do things like force nursing homes to take in COVID-positive patients, which, by the way, he claims the feds told him to do. That's not true.
No.
If you look at the guidance, what the feds said, they never said put infected people amongst a population most vulnerable to the virus.
What's amazing,
yes,
is the feds
Democrats finally, you know, question his emergency powers, and I say it's about time. Who should have emergency powers for a year?
Well, no governor should, because as you have seen, and we've seen this in every state, basically, once they have that power, they are not letting go. And so, Kelly, thank you so much for your coverage. And New York Post has been on this from the beginning.
All we hear of the is
good
radio
work.
Gaga.
You've got the coverage and press on Andrew
radio
Cuomo.
Thank
you so much.
Radio Gaga.
Kelly, that was
Radio Gaga.
This was the Dan Proft Show.
Kurt Schlichter is one of my favorite people. He is an extremely busy man. In addition to being a very fine cook and a wine connoisseur, you could see his cooking tips, especially reverse searing a steak, which I've never really done until I started watching Kurt and a couple other people on Twitter do it. He is a lawyer. He is an author. He writes for Town Hall. He hosts radio shows. He is on Twitter all the time, talking about very important things and making fun of people, a lot of people that we like to make fun of. So, Kurt, thank you for taking some time out of your super busy schedule to chat with me.
Oh, my gosh. It's my pleasure, Julie. And, you know, we are hated by the same people,
yes,
including a bunch of bow-tied virgin losers who never conserved anything yet call themselves conservatives. They hate us a lot because we hold them to account.
Well, we like to judge people by our enemies, so we're happy to have them as enemies. And you know who else they weren't fond of, Kurt Schlichter, is Rush Limbaugh, the late, great Rush Limbaugh. I want to talk, before we get into the Lincoln Project, talk a little bit about Rush Limbaugh's influence on you, because, of course, he's influenced all of us, and what he meant to you, and a little bit about his legacy.
Well, clearly, to me, Rush and Andrew Breitbart were my two greatest conservative influences, outside of Ronald Reagan, who was president when I was coming up as a college student and writing conservative stuff. I mean, I came back from the war, and by the war, I mean Desert Storm, because I'm old. And, oh my gosh, that was 30 years ago.
Wow, it was this year.
That's freaking me out right now.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh, right now the 100-hour war was just coming to an end, and I realized that I was going to bring all my guys home, so that was pretty good news.
Well, thank you.
And gals, I know.
Thank you.
I came home, and I was going to go to law school in Los Angeles. I lived in the suburbs of San Francisco, which was, even then, getting pretty liberal. And a kid across the street I grew up with, Mike, he says, Kurt, you got to listen to this Rush guy. What's a Rush? And that was my introduction. You know, there is something new, something you haven't heard before. And I had always liked talk radio, right? But the talk radio wasn't like Rush. Talk radio was a lot more genteel, a lot more moderate. Rush started saying things that no one was saying. Rush, remember, Rush came out. We had Ronald Reagan kind of speaking for us for 8 years. And then George H.W. Bush gets in. And he kind of thought us deplorables were pretty deplorable, even though that term hadn't been affixed to us yet. Mm-hmm. He kind of, you know, I don't want to be, you know, these young Romians. So we didn't really have anyone speaking for us. And then Rush comes along, and he fills that void that Ronald Reagan left. And he just didn't take any cut from these guys. He saw right through them, and they hated him. They couldn't stand him. They were like, oh, my gosh, you can't say that. And Rush is like, yeah, I'm going to. And that, you know, Rush was the guy who turned around Andrew Breitbart from kind of a moderate, apolitical, kind of center-left kind of guy to into Andrew Breitbart. I mean,
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Andrew was driving around Hollywood delivering scripts. That was his job. And Orson Bean, who became his father-in-law, kind of a raconteur kind of guy from the 60s, 70s, said, hey, you need to listen to this Rush Limbaugh guy. He was dating Orson's daughter. And he did. He turned on the radio in his car and listened to him as he drove around Hollywood. And then a few months later, he met Matt Drudge.
Wow. I haven't heard anyone tell that, make that connection. That's really powerful.
Oh, absolutely. The I think Rush was kind of the fertilizer for the conservative hothouse that brought so many of us out. I mean, he was always, you know, all of around when Andrew started getting active in 2008, 2009, and all of us kind of came out of that, you know, the Breitbart guys and folks in that orbit like yourself and Liz Sheldon, Ace, and all the other folks. The thing we had in common, though we all had different styles, we all had Rush as kind of the foundation. I mean, you literally cannot overestimate his importance. And he is not just an entertainment figure, though he's a terrific entertainer. He is a historical figure who really helped create huge changes in American society. And the hatred of the left for him and their celebration of his death, which, besides revealing exactly who our enemies are, is a testament to how powerful he was. And his legacy is going to continue.
I think
we are all Rush.
I think that's perfectly said. I think one thing that you said at the beginning, you and I and this side, so to speak, is we're targeted by not just the left, but the Never Trump right. Rush taught us, he was the original target, I've said a few times on the show today, the original target of cancel culture. But he also showed us how to confront that, know who your enemies are, know who you are, and never submit to the mob, because they went after him viciously a number of times.
Absolutely. He refused to back down. And if you do what Rush does, you're going to do a lot better in cancel culture. I keep seeing these people, like the guy on The Bachelor. Apparently he said, hey, this white supremacy stuff is, you know, getting out of hand. And they cancel him. And he comes out and grovels an apology.
Right.
You told him to go to hell.
We've said
Peter
this.
Peter Carano
how many
had
times?
It right.
Right. And you've done this. You've shown the way, too, especially on social media. They want to come after you. You get right back in their face, and you don't back down, because these people are lowlifes. They're beneath us. And it's not just us personally they want to destroy. They want to destroy everything that we represent. And Rush understood that.
Oh, Rush understood exactly who the other side was. The thing about Rush, and I'm a trial lawyer, you know, when we have trials again, I'll stand in front of a bunch of normal people and try and take a difficult subject and make it understandable to lay people. You know, I mean, a lot of my stuff has a lot of technical stuff. You know, I have experts in. So my job is to simplify things so everybody can understand and make a fair and honest decision out of it. That's what Rush did. And that's the skill of being able to take complex stuff and turn it into something that every single American can understand. Like the Constitution was written that way. It was written so, you know, a farmer out in Maine could pick it up, read it, and understand what it meant. That's what Rush did.
And it's not, and that is a undervalued skill. That's this guy without a lot of traditional education. You're going to hurt people. And that's the college dropout. I went to Harvard.
Right.
Yeah, maybe. So? But A, you don't understand the stuff as well as he does. And B, you can't explain it, which proves you don't understand it. Rush got it. Rush understood. He was a tremendously intelligent guy. But more importantly, I think he was a very wise person.
Very wise, and he was never in a position where he was trying to impress or placate or be part of that fussy crowd, as you call them, the I-never crowd at National Review or Weekly Standard or the Heritage Foundation. You know, he never was trying to impress them. He knew who his audience was. Hey, yeah. Kurt, on the other side, we'll talk a little bit more about that, but I want to talk about how we are going, California is going to cancel Gavin Newsom. Let's talk about that next.
I'm still standing. Yeah.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Back with Kurt Schlichter, my friend and guy who just does everything, has more energy, I think, than anyone I've ever seen because he just goes nonstop. So he is a Californian, and we want to hear what's happening with Governor Newsom. It looks like they have enough signatures so far. We're going to see signature verification come back in style. But it looks like
it's important.
Yes, exactly. They're going to go through every little cursive mark and zip code. What's happening there, though? This really is a change of fortune for Gavin Newsom, the poster, you know, the cinematic governor of California.
Well, Governor Hairstyle's been a terrible governor. He's also a terrible leader, and we're actually seeing more of this. He went out to the French Laundry restaurant, very fancy restaurant, while closing down other restaurants. And I don't understand. Well, I'm a military guy. Okay, if you're the battalion commander and your guys are in the field, you sleep in the field. And if it's raining, you get wet. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm so sad about the Ted Cruz thing. And I like Ted Cruz. But, dude, I get you want to take a vacation. I get it, the schedule. You can't do that.
Right. Tone deaf.
Okay? You can't. Mm-hmm. It's just you can't. And it's not. And maybe it's not fair. And maybe you have a really good reason, but you can't do that. But that's the essence. And I think for Ted Cruz, I think it was a mistake. For Gavin Newsom, I think it was emblematic of his elite upbringing. He was a rich kid, and I think he just doesn't think the rules apply to him. But it was, and that really symbolizes the problem with it. You see this guy here in California, and I'm sitting there and I'm looking at this beautiful blue sky. I'm in cargo shorts and flip flops. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm looking out the window at this beautiful place. I love California, and it kills me it's full of communists. Only socialists could wreck California, and they've done that. They made it impossible for most normal people to live. Look, I'm a partner at a law, okay? Mm-hmm. I do fine in California.
Right.
All right? I'm within sight of the beach. I ate looking at the water the other day. Life is fine for me, but I'm not the only one in California.
Right.
California is a big state, and there are lots of people hurting, and no one in Sacramento cares, Julie. And the people have to speak. And I think we have a chance to recall this guy. And I think we have a fighting chance to get a Republican in if we don't, because we have kind of a jungle ballot. We need to coalesce around one Republican. And I've heard a lot about my friend Rick Grinnell. And I hope Rick does not run. Because I don't see an upside for him. There's another good candidate who is eager to run, and I'm hoping that we can unite around him and the rich Republican guys can hold off doing vanity campaigns, and we can have one Republican and like 30 Democrats, and maybe get a Republican in office.
Now, is he up in 2022, or is he up next year?
I believe he's up in 2022.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think he is next year. So. It wouldn't be a long, the recall is a practical matter. What it is to yell no, we're done. this is stupid, we're done with it.
What are people the most upset about? Is it the lockdowns, the restaurant closing, the schools?
Yes.
I believe you guys only 5% of your students are in class learning.
My kids are stuck at home doing this video school crap.
Right.
You know, I'm like, what the hell? It's horrible.
And the progressives are turning against him for this too, right? Even the left wingers want their schools open.
Oh, being in California, most of the people I deal with do not believe, you know, as I do. Look, I'm a military Christian right wing conservative. For most of Californians I know, I am diversity. And they're just horrified by the schools. I think the public employee unions, especially the teachers, are just destroying themselves. The government has no credibility. Everything seems arbitrary and unfair. You know, you'll shut down a restaurant, then there'll be a movie unit that has a feeding center right next to the closed down restaurant. And it's not like, oh, they should be shut down too. It's like, well, if they can do it, why can't we?
That seemed to be a turning point when that restaurant owner showed the hypocrisy. Kind of seemed like the tide turned.
The thing is, it's not hard to be a good leader. Even let's assume you're still a liberal. You make a rule and you apply it fairly. You change when the situation changes and you don't dig in.
That's right.
You don't listen to one group over all the other groups, like public employee unions. Sometimes you tell your own people, the public employee unions, the kids are hurting. I need you to get back to school.
Mm-hmm. Kurt Schlichter, I'm going to start drafting you to run for governor of California.
Why do you want me to take a pay cut and a prestige cut?
You can find him at townhall.com. You could find him on Twitter a lot at Kurt Schlichter. You can find his books at amazon.com. The great Kurt Schlichter, thanks so much for joining us. Everybody's working for
the listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
There is some delightful political karma happening right now, and that is between Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, as we've been talking about. From the beginning, and I've been following this issue now almost a year incredibly, I wrote an article at the end of March 2020 that said Andrew Cuomo doesn't deserve any plaudits for how he was handling the crisis. He did not have a plan. Originally, he admitted in a press conference at the end of March 2020, New York State did not have a plan how to deal with this pandemic, even though they knew it was coming, even though they were warned in January. They had people coming into Queens directly from Wuhan. You had city officials who were telling people not to freak out about it. You know, famously, New York City's health commissioner said, go ahead, go celebrate Chinese New Year. You had Bill Blasio in March telling people to go out. But Andrew Cuomo and his arrogance, his Big Apple arrogance, his huge ego, of course, bolstered by the media who just swooned over him. And this was people on the left and right. Peggy Noonan wrote this column how his press briefings were a must watch because it put the nation at ease what he was saying. He is finally getting his comeuppance in New York. The flip side is that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who was absolutely vilified from the beginning. If you remember in mid-March, the criticism started against him. Kids were doing their normal kid thing. Spring break, they were out at the beaches in Florida. The country went crazy. The media accused these kids they were going to go home and kill grandma. And DeSantis did shut down the beaches. But he originally, and I spent a lot of the early quarantine days in Florida, luckily, he was a very reluctant person to come around to the lockdowns. He did not want to lock down his state. He is a very smart man, military, Ivy Leaguer, spent time in Congress. He's young. He's only 42 or 43 years old. But he understood what was happening. He did not want to shut down his state. Unfortunately, President Trump called him in March when President Trump wrongly took the advice from Deborah Birx and Anthony Fauci to shut down the country again for another month, which is what he advised. Ron DeSantis did not want to do that, but he did shut down most of the state. He was early on starting to open things up, starting to open up restaurants, commerce, business, et cetera. And I think his state was was the only really big state at that time bucking the groupthink and the bullying around lockdowns. So now we actually have a ton of data in. The whole state really opened up in September, and he said, we will not have a statewide mask mandate. We are not going to have limitations in bars and restaurants. We are going to open up our office buildings. Our kids are all going to be in school, full-time, in-person learning, masks or no masks, no social distancing. You have high school sports. It is a place that I travel back and forth to, Illinois to Florida. Not only are things buzzing down there and people are normal, people are happy, while the rest of the country mostly is miserable. But what's good is that even the left-wing corporate media is starting to take notice, and saw this week on MSNBC, Stephanie Ruhle pushing back on one of the biggest panic pushers, Andy Slavitt, who's all over social media, regular media for the past year. You know, we're all going to die of COVID-19. He's now one of Biden's top coronavirus advisors. She confronted him, though, in an interview this week and about the data between California and Florida. And here's how that went down.
California basically in lockdown, and their numbers aren't that different from Florida.
Well, good morning, Stephanie. Look, there's so much of this virus that we think we understand, that we think we can predict, that's just beyond a little bit beyond our explanation. What we do know is that the more careful people are, the more they mask and social distance, and the quicker we vaccinate, the quicker it goes away and the less it spreads.
Ha, really? A year later, there's still a lot about a virus we don't know? No kidding. Guess what else we know, Andy Slavitt? Your social distancing, face mask, lock everything down didn't work either. Because the virus is still here, because that's how viruses work. Once again, another confession by people who have been put in powerful positions, by people who tens of millions of Americans have listened to, destroyed their own businesses because of it. Now admitting, gee, we don't know a lot about this. No kidding. But here's a guy who helped vilify Ron DeSantis. Here are public health experts like Andy Slavitt, like Anthony Fauci, who hero worshipped Andrew Cuomo up until the past few weeks when the wheels finally came off and now his own party is turning against him. But that doesn't matter. None of this matters. And they're still going after Ron DeSantis because not only is he not cowering to the mob and the media who's been vicious to him, not just national, local media as well. They now have the science and data. Now they're spinning. Well, look at what's happening in Florida. There wasn't a surge. In fact, the biggest surges were in places like California, which has had these horrific lockdowns, kept kids out of school for almost a year. They are the ones that had surges. They have the same climate. They have the same almost everything. Florida actually has a higher elderly population. They have more vulnerable residents in Florida than they have in California. So now we're confronting these fraudsters with the data. And all of a sudden, well, we don't know a lot about this virus. Okay. You know what? You never did. You never did know about this virus, but you sure knew how to tell everybody how to live their lives. And now you're telling people to double mask, and all you can battle about is 6 feet, vaccinations, and all this other garbage that hasn't worked and isn't going to work. So, but here's a little response from Governor Ron DeSantis when the Biden administration leaked that they might do a travel shutdown to Florida.
People have asked me about, there was some type of report about potential travel restrictions on Americans and on Floridians. And I think it's an absurd report that they would be doing that. I think it would be unconstitutional, it would be unwise, and it would be unjust. And if you think about it, restricting the right of Americans to travel freely throughout our country while allowing illegal aliens to pour across the southern border unmolested would be a ridiculous but very damaging farce. So
Well, it doesn't happen often, but let's score one for the good guys.
DanProfShow.com.
Thank you so much for tuning in tonight and hearing all of the lovely, beautiful, humorous, compelling tributes to the late Rush Limbaugh. I'm Julie Kelly. I'm filling in for Dan Proft. Dan tweeted something yesterday after hearing the news because, of course, Dan is a radio man influenced by Rush Limbaugh, like all of us have been. Here's what Dan said. R.I.P. Rush Limbaugh, conservative talks godfather who paved the way for generations of hosts, including me. I can remember first listening to Rush 25 years ago as an undergrad and routinely being late for class in order to squeeze in one more segment, joyful, entertaining warrior. Those were Dan Proft's words about Rush Limbaugh. You know, people were sharing yesterday and today the first time that they listened to Rush. I remember tuning in 1991 during the LA, I think it was 91, 92, the LA riots. And I know my parents listened to Rush. I really didn't. I just graduated from college and just was working during the day, didn't have time to listen to talk radio while I was at work. But I tuned in because I was so alarmed at what was happening. And, of course, the regular media back then, there wasn't really cable news, wasn't gratifying what I was seeing. And so I tuned into Rush for the first time, and of course he started to dig in. He was saying what some of us were feeling, what we were seeing, what we were thinking, but were too afraid to verbalize. And he really got down to what was happening in LA, all the mitigating factors, and really, you know, what a tragedy on so many levels was happening there. And so that's when I became a faithful listener on and off through the years because, you know, can't always listen to radio during the day when you're chasing babies around. But he did become stronger even and galvanize his following at the end. And I know it was great to hear Donald Trump. We'll play this last clip from the president's interview yesterday about his last conversation with Rush Limbaugh.
3 or 4 days ago, I'd call him just to find out, you know, his fight was very, very courageous, and he was very, very sick. And, you know, from diagnosis on, it was just something that was not going to be beaten, but you wouldn't know it. And he is married to an incredible woman, Catherine, who really, every time I spoke to him, he would tell me how great she was. She took such great care. He was very brave. I mean, he, in theory, could have been gone 4 months ago, really. He was fighting till the very end. He was a fighter. A great gentleman.
Yeah, while you...
He definitely was a fighter. He was fighting, really, for all of us. I think he was fighting for the president the last year, and that's what kept him going. And we'll never see another one like him. We'll never hear another voice. We'll never see a big personality like his again. And so we send our condolences to his family, all of his friends, his brother David. Rush's voice might be silent for now, but his legacy will live forever.
This is the Dan Proft Show.